It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and of course, every growing season brings with it a unique set of insect and disease challenges for gardeners, homeowners, and farmers. The Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic is an ally in this never-ending struggle, and today, Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, is here. Hello, Laura.
Hey, Charity.
And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, a diagnostician and extension plant pathologist with the Iowa State University Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, is also here. Hello, Lena.
Hi, glad to be here.
Thank you both so much for being here. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, is going to join us in a few minutes. And of course, we will be answering your questions this hour. And I guess with everything else that has come at us in 2020, one might expect plagues of locusts and all kinds of other things. Laura, give us an idea. How's the growing season look overall? Is this pretty normal?
You know, right now, insect-wise, it's fairly normal, and it's really interesting because insects really respond to kind of the weather conditions, and so we kind of have half the state with fairly normal to maybe even a little bit above normal rainfall, and then the other half of the state where we are here in Ames, we're getting into, you know, some pretty drought to moderate drought conditions, and so what we're observing over here are the aphids and the mites, and of course, Japanese beetles becoming a lot more common, whereas you might not be seeing as many, you know, two-spotted spider mites and things if you're getting abundant rainfall.
Oh, interesting. And so the places with abundant rainfall, I'm guessing, are probably seeing more of the insects that bother us, like ticks and maybe mosquitoes. But what else might we be seeing?
Yes. So, and good point, the ticks and mosquitoes. And, you know, it's great, everyone enjoying the outdoors. And it's certainly, you know, we all really need to get out and go for those walks and things like that. But we're well into tick season. We receive lots of ticks for identification here in the diagnostic lab. And, you know, the big thing we always try to remind people is that ticks have to be attached and feeding before they can transmit disease. And for, you know, diseases like Lyme disease, they have to be attached for, you know, about 24 hours. So it's so important to check yourself for ticks and try to get them off before they even become attached or remove them, you know, right away when you get inside. And you can keep those ticks and you can send us pictures or send us a tick and we can help identify them as well. But, you know, the most important thing is to get them off before they get well attached.
And I know that a lot of people really panic when they see a tick, but are ticks difficult to identify? I guess I've encountered a lot of ticks in my life, so I tend to check out those ticks that I get on me or that my kids pick up or my dogs pick up and decide what's dangerous and what's not. Can we pretty easily learn to identify ticks?
You know, I can, you know, and I have like the great microscope, and so I even have a hard time just kind of looking at them. But even with like, you know, if you have a good digital camera, you can take a pretty good photo and actually zoom in on it and start to see the features. Now, if this is something where you really want to confirm it, you know, you can send me that digital photo. And actually, if you have like a point and shoot camera, often those will have more, you know, I'm not a technology person, but more like pixels and things in your phone camera. Like I usually can't zoom in on phone pictures, but you know, you can email those to us in the clinic. And very often if I can see the mouth parts, just where they've, you know, the part that they have pierced into you in the back of the tick, I can make an identification from the photo.
All right. And we can then know if it's one of the ones that is dangerous or not nearly as dangerous, but still
a little unpleasant. And then you can let your doctor know.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about some common diseases that are popping up this year. Lena, I would guess with the dry conditions and the wet conditions, you're also seeing some pretty different things going on with diseases.
Yeah. Especially those that, you know, if you have the drought being an underlying condition and causing stress, then there's a couple of pathogens that are wreaking havoc these days. Cankers and oaks, and also some of the cankers and things that will go to apples and eventually will go to the fruit.
Oh, interesting. Well, last year when we did this program at the beginning of the 2019 growing season, we talked quite a bit about oak bot twig canker. And you're seeing that again significantly this year, right?
Yes, yes. So that's what you would see on the very tip of the branch, and the leaves will turn brown. Normally, it's on the in thinner twigs, and it will be scattered on the tree. And it's kind of a hard one because if we're talking about a smaller tree, you can do a lot with pruning and sanitation, but with a larger tree, it's a lot harder. And these trees tend to have some sort of stressor, too, that is making this condition worse.
Well, and I think a lot of us are nervous to do anything with oaks in the summertime or during the growing season. So if you see this twig canker, what should you do?
Resist your urge to prune it, because this will be a really bad time to prune oaks. Right now, the beetles that will move oak wilt, the deadly disease of oaks, could, if you do have those pruning cuts, those beetles will bring that deadly disease. So please do not prune your oaks right now in the summer.
We'll
wait when they're dormant.
We'll repeat that. Do not prune your oaks right now the summer. If you can possibly help it. So what is
that? Resist the urge.
What are the long-term consequences of this canker?
Well, the Botrytis varia canker, it's more of a cosmetic type problem unless it's combined with other problems. So I know that the tree looks rough, but just be patient and wait to do some pruning and some good maintenance, anything that you can do, especially for those young trees, to keep them in good health, mulching, removing that turf from around the root system so that you have some good moisture on the roots, watering, especially when we have a lot of dry conditions. All those things will help. And when the winter comes back, then it's time to prune to increase aeration and also for the good health of the tree.
All right, let's talk about apple frog eye. What is this?
Yeah, so this one is a really interesting one, and I've seen more and more this year than any other year. So you'll see on your apples, normally we see a lot of rust, which you'll see that is orange in the center and kind of yellow spot that has kind of that yellow halo. Well, this one is different because it's more of a concentric rings that are all brown on the spots that you will see on the leaves of the apples. So right now it's too late to treat it because in general on the leaves, it's just cosmetic, but then the problem is when it will move into the fruit. So what you want to do with this one is you want to make sure that you are keeping your tree properly pruned. Anything that may be dead or dry, the pathogen loves to overwinter there on dead wood, but also on living cankered tissue that will look sunken, and sometimes you'll see black dots on it. And so from there, it will jump into the leaves and then later on into the fruit.
Okay. And how should you respond if this is something you identify?
Well, early on, I think anything that you can do early in the season, especially after petal fall, so we're talking about spring now, you want to make sure that you are very proactive about pruning, taking care of that tree in the dormant season. And then if you are very committed to having a good crop of apples in your apples, then you'll have to think about sprays starting at petal fall.
Okay. And when somebody sees something that they don't know, whether it's an insect or a disease, and they can't identify it and they need your help, Laura, how do they get in touch with the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic and get some assistance?
Right. So we are still open at this time, but we can't kind of take the walk-in samples, and we're trying to get in touch with people via like email and pictures. So the best way is to email us at PIDC@iastate.edu. And even if you want to send in a sample, it's best to start with some pictures and things like that. And then we can coordinate so we make sure that we're here and we get samples open. Because the worst thing for plant samples, if they kind of, you know, sit in the mail room for a day or two, they can really deteriorate very quickly. So the best way is to email us, and then we can coordinate whether or not a sample is needed. And, you know, very often we might be able to, especially with the insects, make an identification from the photo alone.
This is a pandemic problem I had not thought about until this moment, because I can guess that not only would they be hard to identify, but you might get some interesting smells in the mailroom if if things sit around too long.
Yes, yes. So we're careful in the lab that we're not, you know, there's not multiple those of us in the lab, so we're not here, you know, normal every day, but someone is by every day to check mail. But it really does help to know, you know, what is coming. And so we can make sure to get it out of the mailroom. Because, yes, some things deteriorate very quickly, and mailing in this heat isn't nice.
I want to ask also, Laura, because I know that at the beginning of 2020, it was in the spring, and we talked about this with Donald Lewis a few weeks ago, but people were really, really worried about murder hornets, so-called murder hornets, invading the United States. And are you hearing from people who are worried that they're seeing those?
Yes. So it's the kind of the murder hornet. It's the actual name is Asian giant hornet, but it's a little too late. They're always going to be called murder hornets from now on. And so that's a very large wasp and has really only been found in a very small location in the, you know, British Columbia and Washington state. So it's not something that we really expect to see in Iowa. But right now we have the cicada killer wasps coming out. And those are the biggest wasps that we have in Iowa. And they're very noticeable because the males tend to cruise around and protect their territory. So they're usually flying around a few feet above the ground. The female collects, she paralyzes cicadas, drags them to her underground burrow and lays eggs on them. So these are really harmless wasps. So we kind of want to encourage people always to report invasive things and things that they haven't seen before, but we're also a little concerned that a lot of, you know, harmless native wasps will be killed because people are concerned that they're murder hornets. So it's a little bit of a balance of, you know, try to get me a picture if you can, you know, without having to actually kill the wasp.
All right. And cicada killer wasps look terrifying, but are really harmless, right? For the most part.
You would have to really grab the female, and the male can't even sting at all.
Okay. So leave them alone. Maybe even enjoy watching them.
Of course.
With me today, Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, and Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, diagnostician and extension plant pathologist with the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Richard Giron's going to join us in just a moment, and you can join us too. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us now, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. Also with us today, Laura Iles, director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, and Lena Rodriguez Salamanca, diagnostician and extension plant pathologist with the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. And we already have a bunch of people on the phone, so let's talk to Bob. Hello, Bob.
Yes, good morning. I have several questions. The first in regards an ash tree, which I thought was dying, but it seems to be leafing out from the bottom all the way up to the top again.
All right, so that sounds like good news, Bob. You thought it was dying based on what? What did you see?
Well, it had a lot of dead branches in it, but now I see growth going, like I said, from the bottom all the way up to the top and getting new branches on the area that were dead.
Oh, interesting. Lena, do you want to?
It appeared to be dead.
You want to respond to that?
Yeah, so I wonder if what was happening here was anthracnose. Early in the spring, we will have some dropping leaves on ashes. Normally, we'll start from the bottom of the tree and then move up. And that's a pathogen that we see every spring. But later in the summer, when there's less moisture, we see less and less of the foliage falling. So, yeah, probably that's what it was.
Okay, all right.
The only thing is this has been going on for a number of years. The branches were dead for a number of years, but now they're starting to come back.
Are you treating this tree for emerald ash borer? Are you in an area where emerald ash borer is common?
I assume that's what it had, and I thought that's probably what was causing the problem, but being it's starting to leaf out again, I'm assuming it wasn't dead after all.
Yeah, so emerald ash borer, the beetles start in the top of the tree and work their way down. And what I've kind of observed is you end up with a tree that's kind of thick, like really gets really thick in the middle. So from a distance, it looks kind of thin at the top, but then right in the middle of the tree where the major branches come out, there's a ton of extra leaves and like pretty large leaves. So it like really looks dark green and full right there in the middle of the tree. That's pretty typical of green ash as they're dying from emerald ash borer. So that could be the other possibility too. And you're welcome to send us a picture as well.
Okay, I have another question too regarding hollies. I have a number of holly plants. I have a couple of different locations, and one location is probably maybe 35 to 40 feet away from the other. And I do have male and female in the first location, but for some reason, the location that's 35 to 40 feet away never produces flowers or berries. And there should be a male and a female in that area as well.
Richard?
Well, when you plant something, it may be a few years before they are mature enough to flower. The actual flowers themselves are very small. They're rather inconspicuous, but it may take a few years for the plants to grow and mature before they do begin to flower.
Wow. Should it take 15 years?
No. I would say 3 or 4 years.
Well, they've been there a very, very long time. They're doing quite well. They're leafing out all it. They're growing, but they never seem to ever produce any flowers or any berries. And they're close to another group of hollies. Like I said, they're maybe 40 feet away.
Are these Missouri-type hollies or?
As well.
What was your question again, Richard?
Are these Missouri-type hollies, or do you know?
They're supposed to be, yes.
Okay. Well, I would expect them to start flowering within 3 to 5 years and then forming fruit. You do need both a male and female, and if you have both of those, you should have fruit within a few years.
Right. And also, within 30 feet, that should suffice as well, correct, as long as it's a...
I would say within like 50 feet, that should be sufficient.
Okay, well, they are within that. They're that close together, so,
that's
the reason I thought I'd better check.
Yeah,
going
that
on.
Sounds like a mystery we are not going to be able to solve, Bob. Unfortunately, that sounds frustrating.
Okay, well, thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks for giving us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have a tweet from Anna. She says, my cucumber plants have been wilting and shriveling up with no indication of mildew on the leaves or pests. I sprayed them with neem oil early in the growing season. Any thoughts on what she might be encountering? Lena, does that sound like a question that you would take?
Yeah. So there's a couple of wilts possible. One very common is a bacterial wilt. For that, as you see wilting, you may want to check one of the stems. And when you cut with a knife, sometimes you'll see like this slimy white stuff. And so, unfortunately, a cucumber beetle will bring that to your plant, and that bacteria will clog the vascular system of the plant, and it will look completely wilted in a matter of, some days and weeks.
Okay, and is there any hope?
Well, I have to tell you, I have to given up growing cucumbers in my own garden because I don't have enough space to move far away from the beetles, and they always come anyway. But I think there's some netting that could help, but it has to be fine. And I think, Laura, what do you think of insecticides for the beetles?
Right. So once the plant has the bacterial wilt, the beetles can feed on it and spread to other plants as well. But yeah, the netting is a really great way to prevent it, but there's not much to do once it already has it. And insecticides can help, but again, if it just takes, one beetle carrying the bacteria. So I would really investigate that netting early in the season and prevent infection in the first place.
All right. Better luck next year is the message that I'm hearing there. All right. Let's go back to the phone. Susan is on the line in Ames. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. I overwinter several geraniums in my dad's garage every year. He's got nice south light and keeps them alive for me. I don't have to repot them. And I've noticed this year that we have a lot of tussock moths nibbling away at things, and one geranium in particular has really, the flowers are fine, but the leaves are really eaten up. And I'm wondering, is that a geranium I do not want to bring and expose my other plants to next fall? Or do the moths lay their eggs in a different way?
So you're just overwintering the pots and the geraniums in the pots?
Yes. I just don't want my other geraniums to end up being eaten like this one is.
Right, right. So I would not, tussock moths are not something that I would worry a whole lot about overwintering and things like that. And we've had a lot of just kind of caterpillar damage, but no, they're not one that kind of overwinters in debris and things like that. So I wouldn't be concerned about it.
Okay. Susan, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number. Patty's up next in Des Moines. Hi, Patty.
I have a tree in my yard. It flowers, but it doesn't bear fruit. It's probably 20 feet tall. And when I'm sitting under it, a little brown slimy thing lands on me, maybe once every half an hour or so. It's about the size of a baby aspirin. It's not big, but it's brown and slimy.
And do you know what kind of tree it is, Patty?
No, it's, you know, just 20 feet tall. It doesn't bear fruit, but it has flowers.
All right. Richard, what do you think?
Still not sure. Does it have white flowers in the spring?
Yes.
Okay, but it doesn't bear fruit.
Correct.
So I'm thinking it might be possibly a pear.
No. It's a bug. I'm sorry. It's a bug that lands on me.
He's working on the tree first.
Oh, okay.
So I'm thinking it might be a pear or a crabapple. And I can't think of an insect that would be doing that at this point. Laura, do you have an idea?
Brown and slimy was the insect.
But it's
it's light brown and slimy and small, the size of a baby aspirin when it's all curled up.
Oh, and it's actually an insect, because I'm sorry, I missed that earlier, that you can tell that it's an insect when it falls on you.
Yes, it moves and it's slimy.
I mean, they do get, there's something called, it's a type of sawfly called pear slug, but they tend to be a little bit more green in color, but pear slug is about the only thing, aside from actual real slugs, which we wouldn't see up in trees. So pear slug could be a possibility, and they're a sawfly, and they feed on the leaves and will cause, you know, holes in the leaves and things like that. Other than that, I am completely stumped.
Could you take some photos again? Maybe some photos of these?
Yeah.
Okay, and send those to the clinic. That might help.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thank
you. Patty, just a reminder, the email address for the clinic is PIDC@iastate.edu. We're running into a lot of stumpers today. 866-780-9100. Call with your easier questions. 866-780-9100. You can call with hard questions, too. Bob's up next in Iowa City. Hi, Bob. Bob, are you there?
Hi, yeah. This is Bob calling. This is Bob calling from Iowa City.
Yep.
And we have an insect infestation on two magnolia trees in our yard. One is about 50 years old or more. One is 4 years old. And the infestation is sort of hard, oval-shaped casings, and inside of each one is a worm. And when some of them move around, when they break out of the casings, they are white and furry. And below the trees on the ground, and this is about a 35-foot diameter, all of the vegetation, which is mostly myrtle and old-fashioned hostas, has started with a sort of 50% coverage, looked like it had been sprayed with a dark material, and there's quite a number of spaces at this point that are solid black. Originally, that material was that residue was sticky and shiny. The casings and the infestation is only on the newer woody stems. Especially on the young magnolia tree, which has green growth. The other tree doesn't seem to have any new growth. And the big tree looks pretty stressed and a number of large limbs die this spring and over the winter. What is it? How can I eliminate it? Will it hurt the trees? And who can be called to treat it if that's viable?
Right, right. So this sounds like what you have is magnolia scale. So actually what you're looking at, these large kind of lumps, are actually the entire body of the female scale. As these scale insects feed, their poop, their excrement, rains down from the tree, and it contains a lot of sugars from the sap, like they don't digest all the sugars. And so that just kind of forms a halo underneath the tree, and then sooty mold is what grows on it, which creates that black coloration.
Okay.
And you also get dieback of the leaves in the tree from the sooty mold. I would say the magnolia scales will build up over time, are a serious problem, and so you do want to manage it. This can be something that you hire a professional arborist to do treatments. The spray times are late summer to fall, so this is a good time if you want to have a professional treat it to make some phone calls and get some estimates on the treatment with insecticide. To do it yourself, you would have to get good coverage on the trees. Again, a product labeled for scales on magnolia applied kind of usually August through September, two different sprays, about 7 to 10 days apart. From what I've observed, this is not usually a kind of a one-and-done thing. You want to probably plan to treat again next year and then really keep an eye on it. They're usually pretty obvious when you have them, and just treat until you don't see them anymore, but it could take a couple of years of treatment.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for your call. Let's get to some email questions here. Our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. From Rick in Elkader, a spring storm broke the top of a pin oak near our farm buildings. The tree is now dying rapidly from what probably is oak wilt. Is it too late to do anything to prevent the spread to other nearby trees or to oaks in our woodlands, which are more than 100 yards away? Should I try to cut the tree down and burn it, although it's green and would be difficult to burn? What about cutting it and waiting for a year to use it for firewood? Lena, what do you think?
Oh, so many questions. yes, I think I would love to see photos if you don't mind sending some. It could be oak wilt, but it could be some other things too. As far as protecting that tree, I'm afraid it's not such a good idea. You may want to consider protect trees nearby that are healthy and they're a high value, but especially once a tree has symptoms, it's just as demise is coming, and no treatment will really help out. As far as removing, there's so many steps in there, and that's what I would love to have your email to send you all the steps. But you have to make sure that you will remove the tree, debark the trunk, because fungal mats, the pathogen itself, will form in the spring right on that trunk. And so you have to make sure that you're preventing that, so that you're protecting other trees. Otherwise, if you don't do that, the beetles will find those mats of fungi, and then they will take the oak wilt fungus to other healthy trees.
Okay, so he should take pictures and get in touch with you. It sounds like this is a complicated problem.
It is very complicated.
All right, let's try maybe a simpler question. This one's from Hank in Washington. He says he has one of several Burpee Roma tomatoes, and last month he had 8 inches of rain total, 2 or 3 inches at a time, a few times. He has a moisture meter. The plants have been maximum wet until this morning, and now he thinks that they are drowning because they got additional rain yesterday, and so he's wondering if they can be saved, if they've been overwatered by nature.
I think they can tolerate that pretty well. It's not like they're going to drown. Some plants are a little bit more sensitive than others. I think they'll be okay. They could, if they want, when the ground gets a little dry, maybe work up the soil around the plant to increase drying and maybe help in that respect. But they're pretty resilient plants.
Okay. And there's, other than working up the soil, there's not much he could do about it anyway, right?
No. But if it does dry up a little bit, maybe work up the soil And then if it gets fairly dry and they need to water, maybe add a little bit of fertilizer in there for some nice growth.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. With me today, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Also with me today, Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, and Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, Diagnostician and Extension Plant Pathologist with the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. And you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University, Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, a diagnostician and extension plant pathologist with the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And let's get to some email questions here. Anne Marie in Iowa City says, I've noticed an overall reduction in flying insects this year. For example, I have no smashed insects on my car and its windshield. Now I'm noticing there are very few green tomatoes on my plants. My apple trees had copious blossoms, but I only have a few apples. I have an issue with my zucchini. They're very short and pencil thin and won't get bigger. I wrote the seed vendor of my Golden Glory zucchini, and they told me I have poor pollination. Have you heard of a lack of pollinators this year? Laura?
There hasn't been a lack of pollinators. We still have a lot of insects out there. It tends to be when we have problems with pollination is that the weather during that window for pollination was really poor for pollinators. So insects like it kind of, warm and not raining. So if there was rain or cool temperatures when that plant was blooming, it certainly could have affected pollination quite a bit.
All right. Well, and we did have quite a long cool spell this spring as we saw corn growing very slowly in the fields and things like that. Might that have been the period in time that could have caused her some trouble?
Right. So we had kind of nice warm weather in April, and then June rolled in and we had some rather cool temperatures. And so when it gets that cool, insects won't be very active. And, clouds and certainly rainfall and things like that will especially keep those bees and things. So it's this kind of unfortunate timing between the pollination time and the weather.
Right. And now we're on the opposite side. Richard, are we concerned about lack of pollination because of heat in some garden plants right now?
Definitely, it could be. For example, on tomatoes, when the temperature gets above 85 degrees, like 90, 95, that tends to interfere with pollination. And so the plants will flower, they will not set fruit. And going back to the squash, you have, with the vine crops, you have separate male and female flowers. And initially, when the plants begin to bloom, most of the flowers are male. So they're not capable of producing fruit. But later on, over the season, then you see more and more female flowers. And the female flowers are easy to identify in that you have a small fruit below the actual flower. With the male flowers, it's just a stem that goes back to the vine.
All right. Here's a question from Sherry in Marshalltown. She says, back when I was building flower beds all around my house because moderation in nothing is my motto and plant information wasn't as easy to come by without Google, I planted bellflower in all my beds, wanting their pretty purple flowers to brighten my landscape. Of course, over the years, it all worked its way here and there and everywhere while blooming. Yes, what a beautiful sight, but I can't physically work as hard as I used to with back issues, and I'm wondering if there's any easier way to rid myself of it in numerous areas. I worked hard to dig out what I could in one place last week, and I'm dismayed to find tiny plants sprouting here, there, and everywhere with tiny roots going in all directions. Is there any hope for me, Richard?
That is a extremely resilient plant. I planted it once, and I regretted it because it's very, very hard to destroy. You have to destroy all the roots, and any root sections that remain will sprout. So you have to be very, very persistent. It's very difficult.
Okay. So in this case, she might just want to give into it?
No, I would keep on doing it, but... Right. But just realize it's not one and done. It's where you have to go out there repeatedly and dig up what you can find and keep on doing it.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Here's a question from Andrea. How would we go about cutting back a 6-foot-tall, gnarly, thorny, wild, or old-fashioned rose bush? It has lots of dead wood and needs some TLC. Can it be cut back close to the ground, and when?
Well, what I would do on that would be any dead wood I would prune out now, because you can see it very easily. And then I'd wait till next spring, around early to mid-April. And if you want to cut it back to, like, let's say 2 feet or so, that should be fine. It's probably not going to bloom much, maybe for a year or two, but it should recover very nicely.
All right. From Eileen in Des Moines, I've heard that you can get a second bloom from bee balm. Do you just deadhead the flower or cut back the whole stalk to do that?
I wouldn't cut back the whole stalk, but I would cut off the spent flower and maybe several inches below that, and if we have a nice late summer, early fall, it should bloom again.
All right. And Laura, I'm afraid I already know the answer to this one. From James in Corning, I have a small hobby vineyard with petite pearl vines. Is there any permanent solution to Japanese beetles? I'm thinking of pulling out the vines and planting something else there.
Yeah, Japanese beetles are certainly a big frustration, and grapes are one of their favorites. They tend to be worse in some years than others, but I think most of us in Iowa experience at least some of them every year. There is no permanent solution other than, unfortunately, using a labeled insecticide on the grapes. You can definitely shoot me an email, and we can discuss different products. Some products will last longer than others, but of course, we have to be careful with anything edible, you know, what products we're using.
Right, and this is a very big problem for a whole lot of people. Let's get back to the phones. Brian is on the line in Winterset. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I have a couple tree questions. Maybe you've touched on this already, but I have a linden tree that recently these black little beetles type things that fly have been eating all the leaves, not off completely, but makes it look like the leaves look like a screen on a window. And the leaves are turning like a color like fall already, and they were a beautiful green to begin with. And they're all over my linden tree for some reason. No other trees in my yard but the linden. So don't know if...
All right, Laura.
And I did some research, and it said it might be a flea beetle, but I'm not sure.
So flea beetles would be very tiny and jump. This sounds much more like the Japanese beetle. This is an invasive insect that's found throughout most of the counties in Iowa now. As you've discovered, linden trees are one of their favorite. They tend to start kind of feeding at the top, although I've seen trees kind of completely, you know, with that lacy-like damage that you describe. You know, the good news is that trees put out a lot of extra leaf material, so the other leaves are photosynthesizing, doing things like that. Occasionally, very rarely, I see lindens defoliated to the point where they actually push out new leaves later in the year. Linden trees are difficult to treat because systemic insecticides are not labeled for them to protect all the pollinating insects. As you know, they produce, you know, great flowers early in the year and are so important for, you know, honeybees and bumblebees and all our native pollinators. You can do contact, you know, a spray later in the year, like this time of year. Oftentimes, you still get quite a bit of feeding damage, and you unfortunately also end up with a lot of dead beetles below the tree. I understand the frustration. I've treated trees before, and then I've got, you know, hundreds of dead beetles. So, no, it's an invasive insect and a big problem, and a problem especially for linden trees and a few others.
All right, Brian, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Carrie in Iowa City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, I have flowering dogwoods, and this year they got their most beautiful bloom and longest bloom, but now the bark is starting to peel on both of them, one a little bit more than the other. I'm not sure if it's an insect that I can't see or if it's systemic. Thoughts on ideas and treatment?
This is a flowering dogwood?
Yes.
Okay. How is the tree as far as leafing out? Did it leaf out well?
Yeah, beautifully. And no browning on the leaves at all. I've gotten a few dead twigs, but the leaves look beautiful.
But it's a fully leafed out tree.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wonder if maybe just some of the outer layers of bark are just kind of peeling off. That can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Bark is basically, for the most part, dead material. And as the tree gets bigger, that bark layer gets thicker and thicker. And sometimes some of the outer layers may kind of flake off. And that's okay because mm-hmm. there's still bark beneath it. So if the tree is fully leafed out and maybe some of the outer layers of bark are flecking, that typically wouldn't be a problem if that's what's
okay.
occurring. Now, if the bark is coming off down to the wood, that's a problem. But if it's just the outer layers of bark, that isn't a problem.
And that's what it looks like. It's smooth. It looks like the wood.
Okay. Well, there's really nothing
Send
you
pictures.
Can do,
really?
You know, if that's the case.
Okay.
All right. Is it coming off on one side or completely around the trunk or?
Actually, now that you say that, mostly on the south side.
Okay. So maybe for some reason, maybe the south side has been injured and now the bark is coming off completely down to the wood. If that's the case, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing to aid the tree. The tree is going to have to deal with that injury as best it can. The problem would be if this continues and more bark comes off, and then eventually the tree gets girdled, where basically you get the tree is disconnected as far as the top from the bottom. And so if the bark comes off all the way around the trunk, the tree will die. But if the injury is limited to one side, the tree will survive. The problem would be, our concern would be, if more and more bark comes off, eventually the tree could die, but there's nothing you can do about it.
All right, Carrie, thanks. Thanks a lot for your call. Sounds like a wait-and-see approach to that one. Let's do a few more email questions here from Diane. Our euonymus ground cover is nearly 30 years old. Last year, I noted small areas where some of the leaves had many tiny yellow spots. This year, many more areas are affected, and there seems to be an infestation of little white insects on the underside of the leaves. Do you know what this might be? Is it treatable, or is it fatal to the ground cover? And I'm not sure who to throw that to, so who wants to tackle that one?
Well,
that's
I know what it is. It's the euonymus scale, and I'll let Laura deal with it.
All right.
So, yes, euonymus scale. They're small, little, tiny white scale insects. Scales can be hard to treat. So, you know, it's a little bit like if you can prune out parts where there's really a heavy infestation of them, again, trying to treat, you know, when the trying to use a systemic or anything labeled for euonymus scale will work fine. It's just sometimes scale insects are just difficult to completely get control of. But again, double check those labels and make sure they're labeled for euonymus scale. And again, if it's a certain section, I would definitely prune that out, remove it from the landscape, and so you're really reducing the amount of scales there.
All right, and that's with a ground cover. That's really a tall order. Okay, Diane, thanks a lot for your question. From Marcy, my full-grown serviceberry tree leaves are turning yellow with brown spots and dropping from the tree. The leaves came out all green this spring. What's going on?
That may be partially, if they're in central or western Iowa, that may be a water issue. Make sure they have plenty of water. If it's spotting, it may be possibly a pathogen of some type.
All right. So keep an eye on that and maybe ask Lena to take a look at that later on, sounds like.
Right.
All right. Let's go to...
Yeah, so
pictures.
Some good photos will be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And again, that's PIDC@iastate.edu, Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. Mary's up next in Des Moines. Hi, Mary. Mary, are you on the line? All right, we seem to have...
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh,
I'm
hello,
here,
Mary. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah, I have several, well, one pepper plant in particular, but another one as well, that have... One has not grown at all since I transplanted it. I got it from a nephew that raised it from seed. It's an Italian frying pepper. I planted about 5 weeks ago, and... It's not a bright green, but it's not very, it's a, leaning on the yellowish side.
Okay.
And I'm wondering.
So what I would do is, if you have a water-soluble fertilizer, I would add that to some water and give that plant a dilute fertilizer solution. And I would come back in a week or so and do it again if it doesn't rain. And hopefully that should green it back up and encourage it to grow.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. And next up we'll go to Susie in Ames. Hi, Susie.
Hello. Thank you. Quick questions. I would like to know if and when I could transplant alum and coreopsis.
With the coreopsis, I would say I would probably, if I could, if I had a choice, I would do it in the spring. Mm-hmm. I would not do it now. You possibly could do it, let's say, late September, early October, but I would prefer spring.
Thank you.
What type of allium do you have?
I wish I knew. They were very, very small flowers, buds.
Okay. So I would probably do that in the spring of the year, early.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's try one more call before we run out of time. Now, Sue on the line of names. Hi, Sue.
Hi. My problem is I have this bridal wreath that I planted in front of my house, and I like to leave them natural, so it got huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I trimmed it back some, and I want to trim it back some more, but what I see underneath now is just woody. Will that eventually fill in with green if I trim it back more?
The bridal wreath is a very, very tough, resilient plant. It tolerates a lot of abuse. If you want to prune it, I would typically wait and do it in early spring. And like I said, it tolerates pruning quite well. If you prune in early spring, it's not going to bloom well, but it tolerates pruning very, very well. I would be hesitant to prune right now in the middle of summer.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a
Thank
lot
you.
For your call, Sue. And here's a quick question to go out on. Could irises still bloom this season? Very few bloomed this year.
Well, you have various irises, but your common ones like bearded iris, Siberian iris, they would typically bloom like in basically May. So probably not at this point. Most of them, no.
All right. Well, we are out of time. Richard Geron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Laura Iles, thank you.
You're welcome.
Laura Iles, Director of the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic at Iowa State University. And Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lena Rodriguez-Salamanca is a diagnostician and extension plant pathologist with the ISU Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Charity Nebbie.